The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Welcome to Agribusiness Innovations, and we welcome CBC 94.7 from Barbados. They're joining us today in this special edition. Good morning to you, Mr. White. How are you?
I'm fine, Tosca. Pleasure to be here. I think we have a packed program today with some very important information that's going to be coming out. And I'm happy as well to be joined by Ms. Derry Bowen out of CBC 94.7 in Barbados. Derry, with us?
You will have to unmute your mic as we're not hearing you.
All right. So joining us today, Ms. Alicia Nichols. Alicia, are you with us?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Trinidad. Good morning, Barbados. How are you?
Everything is great. So today's topic, it's in the news every single hour. I don't even want to say every single day. It's every single hour because this situation is so dynamic. And to all listeners, we want to understand what is the potential impact on these tariffs that are being instituted by the United States on a number of countries. What is going to happen to our food supply? What is going to happen to business? So I brought one of the best experts that I can find on the subject matter, and I'm going to introduce just a brief bio on her so that you as well could understand the persons who are going to be providing you the information today. So Ms. Nichols has a BSc, an MSc, and an LLB. She is an international trade and development specialist with over 15 years of experience. She is currently a research fellow and adjunct lecturer at the Sridath Ramphal Center for International Trade Law, Policy, and Services and the Department of Government Sociology, Social Work, and Psychology of the University of the West Indies, where she lectures in contemporary Caribbean trade policy, business government, and the international economy, the political economy, which is a lot of things, of international trade and finance and comparative politics. Her research interests center on small states and global financial governance, foreign investment policy, and sustainable development. So it's safe to say that she is experienced in this field quite a lot. So Ms. Nichols, kind of jumping in this directly, what is a tariff?
Thank you so much, Jody, and please feel free to call me Alicia. So what is a tariff? So whenever we hear about tariffs, we often think that it's something negative, and it really isn't. It's really these taxes on mostly imported goods, but they could be on some exported goods as well. And it's basically used by governments as a way to protect certain industries, certain sensitive industries, or in some cases as a way to protect nascent industries as well. And I'm sure some of your audience would be aware that some of the countries which are doing very well internationally actually developed by using protective tariffs to help their nascent industries develop before they became competitive enough to allow foreign imports in. With regard to the region, however, and this is so for many developing countries, they're also an important source of government revenue. So, for example, in some countries, they could be around 10% of their tax revenue comes from customs duties. And there are various reasons why customs duties are an important source of revenue for countries, especially developing countries. So we have narrow tax bases, in some cases, large informal economies, dependence on imports, and it's often easier to collect taxes at the border than to collect them behind the border sometimes. So when you hear about tariffs, just think they're mainly taxes on imported goods for the most part, but there are some on exports as well in some countries.
You know, I know the Caribbean has common external tariffs, like cassava, for instance. Cassava has a 40% common external tariff. And my assumption is that they wanted to develop the cassava industry, protect it, and that's why that tariff is in place. So then, are tariffs necessarily something bad?
They're not, which is what I was explaining earlier. So they're used in many cases to protect industries, especially industries that are vital for national security, food security. So that's why you will have like many agricultural goods having high import duties on them, because you want to incentivize persons to buy the local products. And you also want to ensure that you don't have a situation where cheaper products from overseas fill your market and basically drive local producers out of business. So they are really an important tool in the government's trade policy toolkit to help achieve certain policy objectives.
In your experience, based on the number and value of the tariffs that have been instituted, have you ever seen this happen before to this extent? Miss Nichols?
This is Freedom 106.5 FM. We seem to have lost our transmission, so we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we will reconnect with our team. This is Freedom 106.5 FM, and now we return to Agribusiness Innovations with our special guests from Barbados as we welcome the team that is from CBC 94.7 FM. And for those who are locked on in Barbados and would like to send questions on the topic, our numbers 1-868-306-1065. 1-868-625-2257, and of course 1-868-627-3223 as well. Jody?
Wonderful. So now, the question that I want to ask is, how will the new U.S. tariffs affect Caribbean agricultural exports to the U.S. in terms of cost, competitiveness, and market access?
And that's an important question, Jody, and it's something that a lot of analysis is being done by various stakeholders across the region. And we know that the majority or much of the exported goods from the Caribbean to the U.S. includes like energy products, which are exempted for the most part, but also some agricultural products. So things like root crops, for example, are not among the Annex II listed products which are exempted. And therefore, since they used to be allowed duty-free into the U.S. under the Caribbean Basin Initiative legislation, they're now going to face a 10% tariff, which wasn't there before. The question is, to what extent will that change the demand for those products? Bearing in mind that many of those products are bought by persons in the diaspora. So, you know, on the face of it, one might say, because they're bought by people who attach a nostalgic value to these products, they might be more willing to buy the products with this 10% priced in. However, along the value chain, along the supply chain. But at the same time, we will still have to do research and find out to what extent is that 10% going to really make a difference. But to answer your question, indeed, it will impact agricultural exports from the region to the U.S.
These tariffs that have been implemented, it's across the board more or less, other than the exempt ones, right? So it's not like some commodities would face increased tariffs versus others.
I am sorry, I am not hearing Jody.
I'm sorry. So it's that we got flat tariffs. It wasn't that some commodities are facing certain percentages and others are facing another.
No,
in trying to understand why these were put in place, Why is it so important for a country, say like the United States or any country, to understand the balance of payments position, the relation of imports to exports? Why is that so significant?
Well, for many countries, particularly those in the Caribbean, one of the things that we are concerned about, of course, will be with regard to your foreign exchange reserves. And obviously, we pay for imports using these foreign exchange reserves. Now, that's not an issue for the U.S. because, you know, they're the world's reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is the world's reserve currency. I think for them, what they are particularly concerned about is what they view as this this lack of manufacturing capacity, especially what happened during COVID, how it poses a perceived national security threat for the U.S. There's also concern about the loss of jobs. So you have certain cities in the U.S. which made a lot of their, got a lot of economic activity because of manufacturing, whether it's automobiles or other manufactured products, large manufacturing products. And of course, as the U.S. would have negotiated more trade agreements, or as companies saw it a lot more feasible for them to outsource jobs overseas or outsource manufacturing production capacity overseas, then there would have been some jobs lost in the United States. So it's really multifold for the U.S. with regard to their concern over their balance of trade deficit. I think they're particularly concerned about jobs, as I mentioned. They're concerned about what they see as critical manufacturing capacity no longer being onshore, but in other countries, and them having to then import those goods. And I would say that lastly, because a lot of that manufacturing capacity has gone to China and, you know, some Southeast Asian countries, but particularly China, which the U.S. has had a quite fractious relationship in recent years in particular, they are concerned about that as well.
You know, I'm an exporter. I have some business in the U.S., and when the situation emerged, I had a shipment that was going to go from China to the U.S. Doesn't come out to the Caribbean for that one. And over the space of 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, the tariff changed from a small amount, then to, it went all the way up to 125%. And it is a little bit scary, a little bit confusing, because you can, it feels as if you can ship something, and by the time it lands, if it gets 125% increase, then price is double and you've lost. So then, how, what should companies then be doing? Waiting and seeing? Should we be holding off? Do you have any input on that?
You know, what you face is what a lot of companies are indeed facing. And there have been several approaches that they have used. You know, some have entered into discussions with their distributors. Some have done contract renegotiations. Some have directly lobbied their countries and ask their countries to lobby the U.S. government with regard to these things. So there are various mechanisms and various avenues that companies have been using. Another thing is that, and I know it's not a panacea, it's not something that is going to be immediately available to every company, but some have decided to look elsewhere, you know, diversify. And that's something that we certainly heard a lot about over the years, but increasingly more now because the U.S. is seen as an unreliable market right now, because our uncertain market right now, I should say. because of these tariffs and other trade policy issues, because it's not just the tariffs. There are other trade policy issues that and trade adjacent issues that we have to keep monitoring as well.
I saw an article that says that the Caribbean doesn't necessarily want to negotiate as individual islands. We want to negotiate as a collective. Think that collectively, if we get together and try to appeal, negotiate, change what is happening now, do you think the Caribbean has that sort of power or influence that we will be able to change minds?
I think we do, and I think you're already seeing it happening. So but you probably would be aware of the hearings that had taken place over the past few weeks with regard to whether the U.S. should implement these port fees on Chinese manufactured vessels and shipping companies that have over a certain percentage, or, you know, any Chinese manufactured vessels. And they would have been subject to some really exorbitant fees if that were to come into place. And the region, with many of the U.S. shipping lines, really mounted a very, I would say, compelling case at these hearings with regard to the implications that they would have, and also the ways in which it will hurt the U.S. as well. So I think working together as a unit, as opposed to individual countries, is definitely much more in our interest. Even together, we are still a small voice, but it's still larger than individual countries. And I also think that the strategy that the Caribbean has been using, leveraging allies within the U.S., whether it's shipping companies, whether it is various groups in the U.S., the diaspora, etc., that is one way in which we've tried to make our voice heard and say, look, you know, we are facing the fallout for a trade war that really and truly we have nothing to do with. We're not the intended targets. We are, as you hear a lot, collateral damage in many ways.
You know, I feel as if during COVID, right, there was this big push saying that we have to figure out how we can feed ourselves because we are so subject to international trade shocks that we don't know what is going to happen to our food supply. We do not grow enough for ourselves. Some countries grow more than others to feed themselves. But it is such a risk that we need to do more. And some work has been done, CARICOM 25 by 25, 30 by 30. But it feels as if that we are back in a position where people are starting to be worried about food again, that 5 years have passed and that we are nowhere near close to where we need to be, and that the status quo has more or less remained. And there is a risk of us not being able to get affordable food. I mean, how much more price shocks can we absorb or face based on salaries that are not really changing and survive? Do you think our food systems then are at risk as a region that really does not feed itself?
Most definitely, because as you rightly said, a lot of the food that we consume is imported. But I also like to look at the situation in a positive light as well, because the truth is that, and I'm particularly concerned about these cuts that are happening at like the FDA and some of these other regulatory bodies in the USA. I mean, we rely on the work that those agencies do with regard to ensuring that the food that we import and consume is fit for purpose. So if you have these cuts happening at these important agencies, then how can we be assured that the products that we import from the US really are of good quality, right? And I think that especially since we have high levels of NCDs in the region, we really should be getting back to eating more quality homegrown foods, whether it's food that we grow ourselves or food that we get from other countries in the region, food that does not have a whole set of chemicals. I mean, you're an agribusiness entrepreneur, so you understand where I'm coming from. Food that is not ultra processed, right? All of these are things that I think this current moment gives us that extra impetus to ensure that our food supply is not just a lot more stable, but also is a lot more natural.
You know, I'm not a farmer, right? My background is after it comes out of the ground, how do you make money from it? But last year I started a farm and I started growing my own things at an increasing amount every month. And there was a small sense of relief, a silver lining to the clouds, I would guess, in knowing that I've been able to grow my own food, so that should things happen, I will at least be able to feed myself and my family on some sort of a subsistence level. I can't grow everything, but I could probably get enough calories from what I grew so that I can feed the family. But then the question comes into me now. Yes, I can grow it, but now I rely on fertilizers, I rely on pesticides, and these things are imported. They go through the US, they may face tariffs in multiple ways. And then that goes up, and now I am less food secure, you know. So you think that there is anything we should be doing in order to protect ourselves at a home level?
Sure. I mean, and I like the fact that you mentioned the whole thing with regard to pesticides and fertilizers. I mean, a lot of those things are cancer causing. One of the most well-known pesticides that are used apparently is has carcinogens, right? And to me, that reiterates the point that why can't we use locally made pesticides, natural pesticides? I mean, people were farming in this region, the indigenous people were farming in this region for millennia. What were they using, right? I am not a farmer, but if I remember correctly, like there's this flower, is it the marigold? I can't remember the name of the flower, but there's this flower that you see some farmers put around their crops that help to repel like certain insects and such like. So, I mean, that's just a more micro example, but I'm sure that there are natural pesticides or other remedies that we can use to lessen our dependence on these imported pesticides that we've been relying on, and which frankly pollute our groundwater and also have negative health implications for our population.
So here's what I got out of what you just said. There may be opportunities for local businesses to emerge. Because
Yes, most definitely.
So local businesses that can take some sort of research, make more natural things. I know there's somebody, he was either out of Barbados or out of St. Lucia that was on this program recently, and he was speaking about making fertilizer, Algas Organics, making fertilizer from sargassum seaweed. So then what are some of the opportunities that could possibly emerge if these tariffs are implemented?
I mean, you mentioned some good examples. You have a lot of entrepreneurs, especially young people who are hungry to get into entrepreneurship and they see problems that they wish to solve. What we need to do is to ensure that we provide every opportunity for them to build their business and scale their business, eventually to be able to export. And I do know that in the region, that's something that various countries and also at a regional level we've been doing. So for example, you have export promotion agencies which are doing a lot of work to facilitate entrepreneurs to become export ready, to scale up their businesses. You have regional BSOs like like Caribbean Export, for instance, which does a lot of great work, providing market intelligence, providing support, doing seminars, among other things. I think one of the biggest challenges that we have, though, is that a lot of these businesses are not known. And I'll give you an example. And this is not agriculture related, but it feeds into what we're discussing here. So about 2 weeks ago, I had won this little prize, and it was a combination of like bath products and soaps and stuff, and it was made by a Barbadian business. I wouldn't call the business on air because that would be promotion, but it was made by a Barbadian business, and these products smelled really good. And I asked myself, why have I never heard of this particular business, this particular company? And it got me thinking. I had even posted this on social media, that this is our opportunity to really celebrate and utilize the businesses that we have, because many of us use Bath and Body Works, you know, and those other international brands. But here was this brand that I got, a Barbadian business that smelled so good, some of the best bath products I've ever smelled. And I'm sure, as you rightly, you know, intimated, that there are many businesses which are doing very good products with regard to agriculture, agribusiness, etc. And we need to find channels in which we can promote and celebrate these businesses and ensure that people are aware of them, because that's one of the biggest problems. A lot of the times people are not aware of these businesses.
Tosca, what's he saying? Necessity is the mother of invention.
That is correct.
Indeed. Indeed.
We have some questions coming in for y'all, as we have our WhatsApp number at 868-306-1065. That's for our listeners in Barbados at CBC 94.7. And if you're willing to send a question, you can send it via that WhatsApp number. So we have one question. Do you think that tariffs would increase again, would rise again? And we have a voice note, maybe with another question. Let's take a listen.
I think we need to just change our food patterns itself. You know, eat more localized and less Americanized. You know, more local stuff.
All local stuff.
I mean, that's one of the solutions, eh? Alicia, what do you think?
Yes, I mean, so to go to the first question, you know, the tariffs, the additional reciprocal tariffs in air quotes, those have been paused for 90 days. But it is likely, we don't know what's going to happen after the 90 days. So to answer the caller's question, there's still a lot of uncertainty. And as was mentioned within the actual executive order, the memorandum in which these tariffs were outlined, it did say that the president could increase the tariffs or reduce the tariffs depending on how the situation goes, right? Not in the exact words, but that was the meaning of it. With regard to the voice note, I think it's an excellent intervention, and that's something that you would hear health advocates talking about a lot across the region, especially given our high NCD burden. We do eat a lot of processed food, a lot of food made with chemicals that we can't even pronounce. So if there was any impetus for us to really return to our roots and eat more organically, I think this is certainly one of those moments. It's not going to be easy. I'm not here to sound Pollyannish or to sound as though this is something that could be done immediately. But I do think that we have to, you know, ensure that we use this moment. We made lemonade out of lemons, right? If you want to call it that. And staying with your agricultural theme.
From your perspective, you work on policy decisions, you analyze what is going to happen. Do you think that these could affect small businesses and larger businesses differently?
In many cases, yes, to the extent that small businesses, generally speaking, tend to, many of them operate in the informal economy, so they're not able to access certain facilities with regard to financing, because they might not have like a bank account, or they might not have the records required in order to get certain financing. And then they might not have the options available to them in terms of being able to do market research necessary to explore different suppliers or different export markets, etc. Which is in comparison to a larger business, which all things being equal would tend to have a greater capacity to do this. At the same time, though, I do think that smallness does not always necessarily mean vulnerability. I think sometimes it could be a plus, because a smaller business could be more nimble and changes quickly because it doesn't have, you know, as many overheads. It doesn't have as much staff and such like, and therefore might be able to make certain changes and access certain opportunities a lot quicker than maybe a larger business that might have to go through various channels before it could make a pivot, right? But I do think that in all of this, what is important is for businesses to seek out what are the export assistance programs and facilities available. I do know that a lot of our export promotion agencies have been making greater strides with regard to making their products a lot more known. But one of the biggest problems is that a lot of entrepreneurs do not know what is out there that could support them and what could help them. And I think that that's why it's so important for export promotion agencies to ensure that they're meeting would-be exporters and businesses where they are.
Great. I like that you said that smaller businesses could be more nimble. I think that that is key. I think we have a voice note.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Hello. Good day. Listener from the UK here. Just wanted to find out, with all the uncertainty regarding the US, do you believe that we should limit ourselves and stop trading so much with the US and look towards the outside to develop trading relations outside of the U.S. and develop new markets outside?
Alicia,
that's a very good question by the caller. And it's something that I know CARICOM has been doing for many years. So we have that arrangement with the U.S. It's not a trade agreement. It's a unilateral preferences scheme that the U.S. extends to the countries within the Caribbean. Now, it used to be much wider, but within the Caribbean, which had allowed duty-free or reduced tariffs for Caribbean goods entering the market. But what we also have, a similar arrangement with Canada, which is Caribbean, and we also have negotiated trade agreements with other countries and other blocks. So for instance, we have the CARIFORUM EU EPA Economic Partnership Agreement. We have the UK CARIFORUM EPA, which was a rollover of the EU CARIFORUM EPA after the UK left the EU. So that preserved market access. And I got that the caller is from the UK. So, you know, to just agree that yes, we do have that arrangement with the UK as well. We also have partial scope agreements with other countries. So we have with Costa Rica, we have with Venezuela, we have with Colombia, we have with Cuba. And Trinidad, as we know, also has been negotiating partial scope agreements with countries around. I think you guys were negotiating one with Chile as well. So the region has been trying to ensure that we have that structured market access. But as we know, market access does not mean market penetration. So it's still incumbent on our companies to ensure that they are able to access these markets. And to the extent that we can, that governments can, the government's trying to find ways in which they could assist and support companies, whether it's by assisting with like financing or market intelligence, building capacity, etc. Like we have our Food Sciences Center here in Barbados, you know, the government could only do so much. At the end of the day, it's businesses which trade. So while it's for the government to create that enabling environment, it's really for the businesses also to, you know, take the bull by its horns and try to penetrate those markets.
The thing is that it's common to think that if a tariff is 20%, that the goods will then go up in market by 20%. And that's not true. It will actually go up by more because there are multiple layers of which goods may change ownership from person to person before it gets to the consumer. So if it goes up by 20% at the port of entry, and then there is a distributor who has his markup, and then there is another person who may take it, a sub-distributor who has his markup, and then the supermarket now has their markup, then there are three layers of percentages that increase, and you can then find that a 20% tariff increase at the port of entry now goes up, the product may go up by, I don't know, 30% in the end. So, you know, it is such that it can have, maybe this is not the right term, a multiplier effect to the final consumer. What do you think about that?
No, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, there are some cases where someone might absorb the cost. You know, it might be the importer that absorbs the cost or some other person. But in many cases, the cost is passed on, and you're indeed right. And then, of course, the person still has to try to make a profit. So, as you rightly said, there would be increased costs at various layers, and it could mean that even though there might be a 25% a valorem tariff on a good, the cost that an end user ends up paying, in air quotes, is much higher. At the end of the day, I think one of the things as well is how you negotiate with your distributors. That's not always easy, especially if you're a small business, small entrepreneur, small firm, and you have a big distributor. It might not always be easy, but I do know that there are businesses which try to do that to see to what extent they could absorb the cost or they could reduce their margins somewhat. And then ultimately, we also have to think about to what extent are the final consumers willing to pay for the product? Because as I mentioned earlier, some consumers might not buy it if it's too expensive, but others might decide to buy it still because for whatever reason, because of the quality or because of the nostalgia that it has. So I'll give you an example. So for me, I don't eat meat. I use a lot of plant-based stuff. So even if a certain almond milk goes up, I remember at one point, a certain almond milk I was using went up from $9 to $11. And I was like, oh gosh, I don't know how I'm going to wing this. But eventually I decided to buy it because of the value that I placed on my health, the value of the product itself. And I think one of the ways that maybe businesses could work around this is try to ensure that there's recognition of the value of their product. So whether it's by trying to get some sort of certification or continuing to improve the quality of the product, I think there are ways in which businesses can ensure that their products remain competitive, even if the price goes up.
I have a friend of mine who just messaged me. They said you use the word ad valorem with tariff. They wanted to know what you meant by ad valorem.
Sure. So ad valorem, so there are three different types of tariffs. You have ad valorem specific and compound tariffs. An ad valorem tariff basically means a tariff, which is based on a percentage of the value of a good. So the tariffs that we're speaking about, like the 10%, the 15%, whatnot, those are ad valorem tariffs because they're based, they're calculated on the value of a good. Then you have a specific tariff, which would be like a price per unit. So like maybe $5 per gram or something like that. And then you have compound tariffs, which would be a combo of the two.
That makes quite sense. So, I mean, there are, I guess, multiple layers to consider with this. How can then regional governments and trade blocs like CARICOM support businesses in mitigating these tariff shocks?
So several ways. So, and I can list some of them that I know are already happening. So for example, their stakeholder consultations rather, going on, which help regional entities to share information, to strategize with regard to what to do, to hear directly from people in the market who are affected by these tariffs, in terms of what they're seeing and how, you know, how they're being affected and their ideas for how, you know, the impact could be mitigated. So stakeholder consultations is one. Second is with regard to the advocacy. So as we know, CARICOM has been advocating to the U.S. government. You know, they had the meeting in Jamaica a couple of weeks ago. PM Motley, from her statement, had written directly to President Trump with regard to this whole tariff issue in her capacity as CARICOM chairperson. Another thing would be with regard to speeding up the process of regional integration. So at the end of the day, we are still a very government-driven integration process. So one of the things that, one of the arguments that has been made is that what needs to happen is to ensure that we remove those remaining barriers to trade amongst us, right? I mean, I wouldn't go into details, but we do know that it's difficult to get certain products into certain countries, right? For whatever reason. So there are some things that we still need to do on our end, especially if it is that we see one of the ways in which we could ride out this situation is to deepen our inter-regional trade. We have to deal with things like regional freight. I mean, it is extremely expensive to travel within this region.
It is.
And I say this to someone who travels quite frequently. Yes. You know, that's a disincentive to regional tourism. It increases the cost of air cargo, freight across the region, you know, among other things. There are other things that we could do, and we need to look at what are the pain points that regional exporters are facing as they try to do business across the region, and have like some sort of checklist, some must-do checklist, where we say, okay, within X date, we need to get this done. You know, we need to ensure that it's much easier to do business across this region, because it certainly is not easy to do business in this region, especially compared to overseas. So those would be my main suggestions with regard to how CARICOM as a bloc could support businesses in particular. And one other thing is, I often wondered to what extent, and I don't know, this is me talking off the top of my head, but to what extent can we have some sort of online regional marketplace or something? Because there's so many great products that I see when I travel throughout the region, and I would not know about them unless I traveled. And it would be nice if there was some way in which we knew about some of these products a lot more, right? When, you know, when we want to buy certain things, like there's this cocoa out of Grenada one of my students have brought back for me about 2 years ago. And every time she goes to Grenada, she brings it back for me. And I always wish I could get it here in Barbados because it's really good. So I think, you know, maybe having some sort of regional marketplace or something would be useful.
Well, as we've mentioned CARICOM, there's a question coming in. How can CARICOM combat taxes in the region? Is this a good time to reduce taxes between CARICOM?
When they said reduce taxes between CARICOM, I don't think they're probably meaning import tariffs, because we wouldn't have import tariffs as a customs union, common market, aspiring regional grouping. What they probably mean, I don't know if they mean in terms of our own domestic taxes. So maybe to what extent we could lower our domestic taxes or lower the common external tariffs for some of these things. I don't know to what extent that's feasible. That's something that CARICOM will have to discuss as a grouping, to what extent they could do that. But in terms of more broadly, reducing the amount of taxes that maybe businesses face, that's something that to determine individually based on their fiscal positions. That's not something that I could really advise on.
You know, I mean, a common marketplace would be good in terms of moving trade. We do have some companies that do have e-commerce set up with Caribbean products, but it still is very expensive to ship in between countries. It is cheaper for me to ship to Miami and then back to Barbados than to try to ship directly to Barbados.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
So,
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was completely agreeing with you. And it really is a disincentive for interregional trade. But go ahead.
So, listen, it sounds like we have been facing so many challenges in different forms, in different ways, as it relates to our food system. What can we then, as a region, do to build resilience against external supply shocks?
Okay, so I like that you asked that question, because the answers I'm going to give you are not going to shock you. In fact, is what everyone is saying, and it's something that we've been saying for many, many years. Diversify and integrate. And that's something that is important, has been important for us for many years and continues to be. And a couple days ago, I actually read this, I have watched this speech given by the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. And I found it interesting that the EU, a market of 450 million people, and with the economic muscle to retaliate against, you know, the US in a meaningful way, said all options were on the table, of course, but also said that they themselves had to build resilience by diversifying and deepening their integration. Now, if the EU, a market of 450 million people approximately, sees those two things as critical to building resilience, who are we in the region? Would that not be even more so important for us? As I said, it's not a magic bullet, but those are two surefire ways in which we could build that resilience. Because the truth is, we are highly dependent on the US market. The US is a friend to the region, but at the same time, as we can clearly see, that deep dependence on the US, both as an import market, a market for our exports, a tourism source market, makes you extremely vulnerable to volatility in policy making in the US, to shocks that might happen in the US, economic shocks, right? So the quicker we could deepen our integration, source a lot more, because intra-regional trade remains very small compared to our trade with the rest of the world. And in addition to that, continuing to deepen our relationships with both traditional partners, like the caller from the UK had mentioned, the EU, the UK, some of our Latin American neighbors, and then more recently, Africa. So I was in Africa several times, in African countries several times last year, and it's interesting the similarities between us. Of course, there are differences, but the similarities, and there are opportunities that I see for us there. And likewise, right? And people sounded very interested in finding out more about the Caribbean water, the opportunities. I know several of our investment promotion agencies have done trade missions to African countries. So Barbados, we have one to Rwanda. I think we have one to Ghana. I'm speaking subject to correction. And I know that we also have the missions. We establish missions in African countries as well as a way to promote our commercial diplomacy, etc. So these are things, concrete things that we are doing. We have started doing from before, but they're even more critical now.
I think Barbados has been making some advancements in trying to develop the local foods. I know the Minister of Agriculture has been putting out things like recipes, and people could come and they could buy sweet potato breads and sweet potato cakes from some of the ministry stores. So I know that there is some things that are happening. I've seen it there. You know, there is a hope that the entire region could actually do more and push harder. Beyond, I think, just these policy changes just take so long, and I don't know how much impacts that they're going to have. We do wish that we see things a lot faster so that when these potential shocks happen, we are, you know, much more protected. You know, this show is agribusiness. I'm wondering, are there any industries you think would be affected by these tariffs in the region more than others?
Yes, so agriculture, as we had mentioned a bit earlier up in the discussion, agriculture for sure, tourism, that would be affected, but indirectly. So for example, for many of our countries, actually for the region, the main tourism source market is the U.S. And even for some countries like Barbados, which were once more dependent on the U.K. market, the U.S. market in recent, more recent contemporary times is now our most important market. Now, that means two things. It means, one, that if there is a severe reduction in Americans' purchase power, whether it's because of the layoffs that you're seeing at the, you know, in federal government, or businesses which might have to lay off people because the tariffs make it unprofitable for them to stay in business or at the scale at which they were, or, you know, the U.S. goes into a recession, then that is going to have implications for those countries in particular which rely on the U.S. market, U.S. visitors, because they might not come, or if they do come, they might spend less, right? Because at the end of the day, what concerns us is not just the arrivals. You know, we place a lot of emphasis on tourist arrivals, but really and truly the most important things for us is the expenditure, right? Another thing would be with regard to the imported inflation that we would be getting. Many of our countries are already high cost destinations. I mean, Barbados most certainly is. I mean, beautiful, but it is still costly. So if it is that because of this inflation in the U.S. being imported into the region, the costs of our goods, many of our goods which we use in the tourism sector are imported from the U.S., it makes your destination even more expensive. And then coupled with an economy which might enter into a recession, then that could have implications for the tourism sector. So manufacturing, agriculture, tourism, all three of those I could see having impacts, negative impacts from these things. And then also remittances as well, because remember that the U.S. is an important source market for remittances to the region. So, you know, depending on how the diaspora fares with this, we might see a reduction in remittances or diaspora investment in the region. You don't know. So, but it's a possibility.
We have two questions coming in. Would dollar devaluation help? And what about a single currency in the region? Would that help as well?
I am really loving these probing questions. Sorry, that's the lecturer in me. I love the probing questions your audience is asking. So with regard to devaluation, I don't know to what extent it will help like a country like Barbados, for example, because it will require us to pay even more money in order to get imports from the US. So I don't really think that devaluation will help for that. It might help some countries which have manufacturing capacity, and therefore if they devalue their currency, it might make their products cheaper. But again, that's something that their central banks and whatnot will have to do the economic analysis on. And I don't think that it is a policy, I don't really know to what extent it's a policy option that is being considered at this time. With regard to the second question, with regard to a single currency, again, I know that's something that has been mooted. You have like the OECS, which has the Eastern Caribbean dollar, the ECCU rather. Countries which have the Eastern Caribbean dollar, that's been beneficial to them. Is it that we are suggesting that CARICOM should adopt the Eastern Caribbean dollar, or we should come up with our own dollar? That's a ticklish situation, and I don't know to what extent there is that appetite right now within the region to make that move. But as we saw with the EU, it does facilitate trade within the EU, having the euro. And I do think that it would facilitate trade within the region if we had a single currency. But I'm not advocating for it. I'm just saying that as a trade specialist, I could see how it could be beneficial.
What's the disadvantage with adopting the US currency?
Of dollarization?
Yes.
Okay. So that's more into economics territory, and I'm not an economist, but I do know that persons would argue that in a way it outsources your monetary policy.
Yep.
Because then you no longer have control over your own currency. So that would be my answer to that. I know some countries have benefited by dollarization, and I do know that a very prominent economist in the region has been arguing for dollarization. Actually, a former governor of our central bank, who I greatly admire, he has been advocating for dollarization, but I don't know to what extent it would be beneficial to us. I'm not an economist, so I can't really give you a economics argument on that.
You know, so I guess that this is an ever-evolving situation. And, I mean, people have to just pay attention, make smart choices, plan, and try to weather the storm. My personal opinion is that it's going to settle down pretty soon. I don't believe that the American population can withstand such drastic changes in the cost of living. These things will be short-lived, just a matter of weeks. It's already been paused and lowered, so I think that is going to settle down. It's bringing us near to the end of the hour. I want to thank Mr. John Birch, he's the manager here, for getting this show organized, for assisting us with this broadcast, as well to our listeners there at CBC 94.7. Thank you to our listeners over there and overseas as well. So, Alicia, what do you have as a final comment based on our discussion today?
Well, first, let me thank you. Thank Freedom 106 FM and also CBC 94.7 FM in Barbados for hosting me. My final comments, and just to piggyback on what you said, Jody, is that There is a lot of uncertainty. I do think that given the fact that you have seen movements within the U.S. Congress to rein in some of the president's trade policy making power, which is really something that was delegated from Congress to the president under the various legislation and whatnot, which he has been using. I think given that movement, given the stock market volatility and then the rebound following the pause, I think given the angst that some Americans are having over, you know, these tariffs, among other things, I do believe that we might see, as you say, some settling down, but I think the region has to remain vigilant. We have to continue monitoring, continue sharing information in fora like this and other fora with regard to how are we going to manage this situation for the next at least 4 years. And also, I think we should leverage the partners that we have, you know, academia, business persons like yourself, civil society, the private sector, etc., work together to ensure that we build, which does not have to constantly feel as though it's on the back foot whenever we have an impending shock like this. And those would be my parting words.
And plant your own food and eat local.
That too, which I completely endorse. Yes.
Thank you very much.
And lastly, look at make lemonade out of lemons. There are opportunities here. Try and find them.
Wonderful discussion today. Thank you, Alicia Nichols, out of Barbados. This has been Agribusiness Innovation on Freedom 106.5 FM. Our time is up. Stay tuned next week for another insightful discussion.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.